The Brendan O'Connor Show on RTE Radio 1 with All Care Pharmacy. Discover a team that's always here to support you at All Care, taking care of communities across Ireland.
Good morning, how are you? Very welcome to the show. I think the Sunday Independent front page sums up, I think we're all a bit doolally and all over the place. A nation celebrates, but COVID anxiety remains, is their lead. The Business Post, Donoghue, that's Pascal Donoghue, defends ending of wage subsidy scheme as he is predicting a spending boom. And let's hope he's right, but there's a lot of stuff flying around there in the ether and people talking about potential insolvencies now. There's that warehouse taxes issue hanging over some sectors, and supports are going to be wound down. Pascal Donoghue saying government cannot subsidise a wage bill of some employers while other employers cannot find workers. The Sunday Times is going with an expert panel to report on COVID lessons, and you would get the impression from it that that they're looking at making this a fairly tight, clean kind of an investigation, not one of these things that's going to drag on for 20 years and have people taking lawsuits against turning up at it and whatever. And there are, of course, pictures on the front of all the papers. Did we ever think we'd get our jollies from seeing pictures of other people having a pint in a pub? But there you go. The Irish Mail on Sunday and indeed the Sunday World, the Sun, and the Mirror, all leading on that story down in Carlow of poor old Padder Doyle, who was brought into the post office. So the pair who brought him in now, claiming dead man was alive on way to shop. And there's varieties of that on the front of all the tabloids. Now, our panel today, Dr. Pete Lunn is head of the ESRI's Behavioural Research Unit. Ciara Phelan is a political correspondent with the Irish Mirror. And Dr. Ilona Duffy is a GP in Monaghan. And Ilona, you are with us in spirit, but you are in a separate room because we figured in the case of an Omicron outbreak in the studio here, you're the one that needed to be saved. So you're out there. The pandemic may be over, but it's not over here. We've all taken antigen tests and we are still operating out of two rooms. So welcome, everybody, anyway. Did anyone do anything yesterday to mark our freedom? Ciara, I don't want to be ageist or anything else, but you seem like the most likely candidate to have been on the tiles.
Well, I had to have my wits about me coming in here this morning, so I didn't hit the tiles last night, but I did go for a nice lunch yesterday and had a cheeky one or two cocktails with a friend I hadn't seen in 2 years, and it was just liberating. The crowds out and about the city, it felt like an All-Ireland day. My friends were out last night. They were FaceTiming me from the pubs at home in Carlow. My friends were out in Mayo. It just felt so good. People felt alive.
Yeah, yeah. And we talked about this a bit yesterday, but I suppose you did miss out a lot in the last 2 years, your age group, did you?
Yeah, absolutely. I think, you know, one of my friends made the point as well this morning that there's so many people in their early 20s that probably haven't ever experienced a night out like that last night.
You
know,
yeah.
And it was probably their first time actually going out and experiencing that. So can you imagine how that must feel? It's emotional. It's very emotional for people. People in their 20s that miss their debs, miss their first and second year in college. I think back to my college years and my first 2 years in college, that if I could turn back time, that's where I'd go. And it's a becoming of age, passage of rights and everything like that. But I have to say, I do also feel for some other generations. Like I think about my own mother and father. My dad retired just before COVID hit, and they had, you know, plans to travel the world and, you know, do whatever they hadn't got to do over the previous years because we're working. So I think it's time for other generations as well to get on and live with their lives as well, because I think a lot of my friends would say, like, I'm 28, and a lot of my friends would say that they felt sorry for their parents, that it was, you know, their later years in life and they should be living it as well. But back to your main point, young people, it's just, the feeling is, I can't describe it. My friends last night, it was amazing.
Yeah. you're never going to forgive me for denying you that night. I don't think today of all days anyone would have judged you if you rolled in here from some early house or something and we'd have to give you cups of coffee and everything else.
I'll have to hold you to that, Brendan, but I'll go out next weekend and I'll have an extra drink. So I will. It was just, I felt so bad last night sitting at the kitchen table prepping while all my friends are ringing me on FaceTime. But sure, look, I'm here and glad to be
here.
You
go. Pete Lund, did you allow yourself a snifter of anything yesterday or a look around?
It's safe to say, as a parent, it's a long time since I've seen an early house, Brendan. not that kind of early house, anyway.
Yeah.
it's fantastic. And I mean, the point that Kira's making is absolutely key. I mean, of course, I'm going to immediately relate it to data, but I mean, all of our data show that young adults are the people who've been hit the hardest psychologically in terms of well-being, in terms of mental illness. So, so this is fantastic for them. And I was really struck in the papers this morning with just a quote from a student saying, I cannot wait to get out and meet new people.
Yeah.
And I think for people in my, who are my age.
We don't want to meet new people.
We know too many
people.
We have obligations to already.
Exactly.
It's hard enough to keep
up. We're all
up
set
with
for people.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
So I think it's really important because, I mean, most of the decision makers here are the middle-aged settled people. And it's hard to remember what it's like when your horizons are expanding, when you're looking to meet new people and partners and so on. So, one feels fabulous for these people and it's great.
And the other thing is, it would be nice to think as well, and from what you're saying, Kira, it sounds true. It would be nice to think that city centres and town centres would be reclaimed by people again and would be alive again, because they had become very bleak, hadn't they?
Yeah, remote working as well. A lot of people are moving back. Like, I'm originally from Carlow. The pubs in Carlow were packed last night. I live with people that are living from Mayo. They're, out of Mayo last night as well. So the whole country, I think we might get a boost in local, the local economy and tourism as well because of that.
I'm certainly hoping so. Ilona, did you allow yourself any bit of jollity yesterday, or were you just exhausted after the last 2 years?
No, actually, I made it to the cinema and got to see Belfast, the movie, yesterday, and the Stellan Rathmines, which was a fantastic experience. And more importantly, I got to go with my mother-in-law, who I think that was probably about the fourth time I've seen her since the pandemic broke out. So it was great. Okay. First of all, the movie, well worth going to see, everybody. I cried half the way through it, but it was brilliant. It was just great.
Okay. I think we can go down to Fleet Street in Dublin now, to the Palace Bar. Willie Hearn, are you there?
Good morning, Brendan. How are you?
I'm good. Willie, was it a good night in the Palace Bar last night?
It was a great day, Brendan, to be honest with you.
Okay, so good day and night.
From early lunchtime yesterday now, there was a bit of giddiness in people and a bit of excitement. Yeah, just...
Yeah.
A bit of normality coming back to everything,
Yeah. Ye had been closed a lot, hadn't ye, over the last couple of years?
That's the best part of 2 years, Brennan.
Yeah.
We did get open for brief periods of times. Serving chicken wings got us open for a few weeks and doing Irish coffees at Christmas time at the door, just keep going and keep staff going, and good for the head as well. Good for the marriage as well.
Yeah, I'd say so. Get you out of the house. Yeah. Come here, and what kind of crowd was in? Ye would have a lot of, even though you're a town pub, you'd have a lot of kind of what regulars or locals or that, wouldn't ye?
Yeah. The regulars and locals have been great to us, Brendan. As I mentioned, those few weeks we got opened, with great support from people from the country as well who've come up for the day.
Yeah. And of course, the bar is important there in the Palace Bar as well. The sitting up at the bar and being handed a pint onto the bar would be a central part of your operation, wouldn't it?
I've often served you one, Brendan, down the years. You know yourself, you come up to the counter, sit at the counter, and nod in a wink from the barman. It's something we all took for granted in a previous life, but please God, it's back to stay.
Yeah. Are you a bit emotional, Willie?
Brendan, the last 2 days has been emotional. On Thursday night when all the messages were coming through, and it just flooded back kind of the last 2 years.
That's it. Did it bring up everything? Yeah.
It did. Come here, it was a tough period for everyone, for the whole country and in all walks of life, not just in the hospitality, people who lost loved ones and that, but simply for ourselves, the hospitality really was at the brunt of all the restrictions, and just to get those announcements on Thursday, it was just a huge, pressure, a relief. Like, you know, it's like I just had to sit down on Thursday. I was being good for January, and I had to sit down and have a pint or two on Thursday night just to reflect on it all and take it in.
Yeah, a reflective pint, the best kind. Come here, what was the best thing about last night?
What was the best thing about last night? I think when it was all done and dusted and the staff sat down and my wife came in and a few friends and there was one or two publicans, and we just, you know, it was just to sit back and just to think how we got through this the last 2 years and how we kind of, friends and publicans, we stuck together, and we kind of, there was times where we were all kind of down at times and kind of supported each other and lifted each other, and to be able to have a laugh last night at a pint and just say we're back, you know.
Yeah, and Willie, are you optimistic about the future? Do you think town will just roar back and people will start coming in again and it'll be busy again?
It's going to take a little bit of time, Brendan. You know, please God, we're going to start seeing a trickle now of people coming back into offices. Like, tourism is a huge part for the country. Like, we cannot underestimate that. Like, when things were bad after the economic crash 13, 14 years ago, tourism was a huge thing that got the city and the country back going again, like, you know.
Yeah.
All those bits and pieces and, you know, matches and events and stuff like that, it's very important.
Yeah. Willie, great to talk to you, and good luck with everything.
Thanks very much, Brennan. All the best.
See ya. Let's check in with JP McMahon. JP, who's a restaurateur in Galway, and you know we've spoken to JP a bit over the course of the last 2 years. JP, there's been times you've been at the end of your rope, times you've been very angry, I think. How are you feeling today?
Yeah, no, surprisingly happy.
For you,
I'm not too happy too often, but it certainly was like a weight. I honestly think if it was a parallel, it was like the end of a war or something, you know, this, because it was like a war of attrition. It was just constant and trying to fight and trying to change, and then another on Thursday, as the Palace Bar was saying, that when all the matches, it was like Ireland winning the World Cup, you know. It was so surprising. I was like, what is happening here? And listening to the messages and then getting confirmation, and I suppose I couldn't believe it. And we're closed for another week, because I suppose I didn't expect, we sent all the staff off for 3 weeks until the 31st of January, because I honestly did not foresee all of this just happening overnight, and I thought like it would be unfair if we just called all the staff back. So we're looking forward to have our own little celebration and bring all the furniture that has been out of the restaurant for social distancing, and like put the restaurant back together, and like just, I suppose, get a little bit of the atmosphere, the buzz in the restaurant that I suppose it's been missing over the last 2 years.
Yeah, I bet. Listen, JP, not to rain on today's parade or anything, but just looking into the near term or the medium term or whatever. So obviously, Pascal Donoghue saying today there's going to be a boom. Also, then the supports, you're going to be weaned off them. So do you think there's going to be a boom? And do you think, are we looking at a lot of businesses going under without those supports?
Yeah, like, it's a hard one to call, as the other gentleman then said. Like, I think a lot will depend on tourism. A lot will depend on, like, on, I suppose, Americans coming back to Dublin, to Galway, to Cork, and eating. And we saw a little bit of that. We had a very good November. Like, I suppose the last 2 years, like, have been difficult, and there's a kind of weird false economy or a bubble because of being like 60% down, but then getting grants, and so we don't really know where we are, so to speak. And then if you shelved your bill to the revenue, you could put that, say. So a lot of people haven't paid that either in the last 2 years. So look, I'm hoping they won't, but they won't close. But I can imagine certain parts of the country are not going to boom. I suppose like after a recession, are not going to boom in the same way. And I think Dublin has been affected deeply. So I suppose it remains to be seen.
Yeah. Okay. JP, good luck. Talk to you
again.
Thanks
so much, Brendan.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
That's JP McMahon there in Galway. Ilona, JP alluded to there, I think, what a lot of people are feeling, which is that this was a lot altogether very suddenly. From your standpoint as a GP, do you think, is it too much too soon for you?
Well, I think any medic that I've talked to or any of the WhatsApp groups that I'm on, there is a sense of anxiety amongst us all just about how fast things are being reversed and how potentially fast things could change again. Now, we all know that Omicron definitely has been shown to be a less severe variant than others. But at the same stage, those who are immunocompromised still remain at risk. Those who are vulnerable will continue to remain at risk. And there's always the potential
for
change.
Can you keep the country and the economy shut down?
No, you can't. You can't. And we've got to open up because for all kinds of other healthcare reasons, we've got to improve access to hospitals, to us GPs, making sure we can get all of the things we want and that there are no more delays because of, you know, barriers that are put in our place. And I think for people's mental health and well-being, we've got to see life return to normal. So I think all of that's to be welcomed. I think there are a few things in the decision-making process that I would have to question, such as the removal of the COVID vaccine cert as a requirement to get into public places such as restaurants and pubs. We know that, look, at number one, it kind of did help, you know, some of the spread. Without a doubt it did. But also we know that the boosters have played a huge role in keeping us well as a country and definitely in reducing serious illness as a result of COVID infection. So what is the incentive now to get the vaccine? And yet we know we still have to continue trying to roll it out. So I think we're getting mixed messages here. We're getting one saying, you know, you won't need any of these vaccine certs anymore to get in anywhere. That's great. On the other hand, saying, listen, keep pushing the boosters, keep trying to get those vaccines into arms, try and protect the general health of the country. But it's just not marrying. And I see already a drop off in those who are wanting to uptake their booster vaccines, especially amongst the young. And I
literally
think
in the last few days alone.
Oh, since last week. Yeah. I did a big vaccine clinic on Friday. Well, it was planned to be a vaccine clinic, a good sized vaccine clinic on Friday. And there were dropouts from that. Before Christmas, we had lots of people coming forward and we were running giving vaccines all day long, every day. And suddenly it dropped to perhaps giving six in a day. And that's with a big push. That's with anyone coming into any pharmacy in town being told, go around to Swan Park Surgery and you'll be able to get a vaccine as a walk-in patient, even if you're their patient, not just purely because we didn't want to see these vaccines go to waste. And that's what's happening, Brendan. We know that vaccines are going to waste.
Have you wasted vaccines?
We have. We've done everything to try and get those vaccines. When the vaccines come to us in general practice, we've 30 days in which to use them. So it's really from that point when they've been thawed. So as we know, they come into the country frozen and they're stored and then they're taken out and distributed out to the various places, pharmacies, GPs and the community vaccine clinic. So you have a period of time. It all seemed really good before Christmas, you know, or just in that Christmas to New Year period. People wanted them. We were aware of queues, people, you know, getting out there saying, where can I get it? So we thought, great, the uptick's going to be fantastic. And then suddenly there was a massive drop off. Now, it's twofold. Number one, it is because so many people became infected with COVID over Christmas and obviously they have to wait the 3 months. But then there was that sense that there was no longer the impetus to get it, the longer the need to have that booster. Okay. And I think that's the message that seems to be coming from the younger members of our public. Why bother? We don't need it to get into the pubs or the restaurants.
Okay, really, but the message is still very clear that the reason we're in good shape is because of boosters. The reason we got on well over Christmas or reasonably well is because of boosters and that people should still get their boosters. Let's just acknowledge that that message is still very strong.
Very strong.
Pete, that's you being quoted on the front page of the Sunday Independent today, that a quarter of us are still nervous. So, like, it's an interesting vibe this weekend, isn't it? Like, that people don't know if they're coming or going in a way. I think that, and like, as Willie was saying there, the 2 years has all come up in a way for people. People are suddenly talking about, remember that first lockdown, remember how bleak life was and everything. Then with the exhilaration of Ciara and the friends in Dublin yesterday, and then a lot of people thinking this is all too fast and everything. So where are people at in their heads?
I don't know where people are at in their heads.
Okay, in terms of the research?
We'll get new data next week. We've nothing post the announcement to go on yet. So I don't know. But what I do know is where they're at pre the announcement. And therefore I can make a conclusion, which is what's quoted on the front of the papers, about how anxious people are likely to be. I mean, just over a week ago, only 12% of the population thought restrictions were going to be eased in February. Let alone now, right? So 88% of us thought we were in the situation we were in until the start of March. So the switchback ride is huge, and psychologically that's bound to be unsettling for a large number of people. You don't have to be a brilliant behavioural scientist to know that that's going to be true.
So there's whiplash, right? National whiplash.
So even though
this
obviously, you know, there's huge positivity, and it's really important to understand that what has changed here is the science and the numbers, not the politics and the opinions and the attitudes. What's changed is we've learnt something. The science has turned in our favour. It's really important to understand that's what's driving this, and it's happened really quickly because we've learnt something really quickly about what happens when Omicron spreads, how powerful the virus is, how powerful our vaccination defences are against it. Also worth noting that our data showed the largest degree of behavioural change that we'd seen since we started recording it. Between mid-December and January, there was a 40% fall-off in the number of close contacts because people had changed their behaviour, were being more careful and were socialising, yes, less. So a lot
And I think a lot of people had their Christmas collapsed and were locked in the house, and some people for two, 3 weeks while the Omicron made its way through the household.
So there was a huge element of that. We measured that. So some of it was people isolating because actually they had it in the household or they had it themselves, but a huge amount of it was not. I mean, people really did change their behaviour, and that's also one of the reasons why we managed, even though it was an enormous surge, to keep some degree of a lid on it.
So the 8 o'clock, which a lot of people are now starting to question and saying, why did we need to do that at all? And I think the Taoiseach's point on it the other night was, well, Philip Nolan wanted to bring down socialisation by 30%. This was one way of doing it. That 8 o'clock probably did play a part.
Our data is absolutely consistent with the fact that the two major policy changes, which was closing hospitality at 8 o'clock and getting people out of the workplace, both of them reduced close contacts and therefore almost certainly had a very big impact on transmission of the disease. Our data is completely consistent with that. It doesn't prove that, but it definitely suggests that that's likely to be true. Okay. But then moving on to people's kind of anxiety with this, I mean, given how quickly this has happened psychologically, I think we've got a lot of explaining to do, actually. So, I mean, this is great news, and I don't want to in any way detract from that.
Yeah.
But I think there are a lot of people who now don't get the narrative. It's like, where are we going next? What am I supposed to do? How much do I alter the dial on how much risk to take? You know, do I still need to be 2 metres from people? Should I still avoid crowded situations? Now, one of the really interesting things to do, actually, is to read the CMO's letter to the Minister for Health. Because although it says unequivocally there's no public health justification for these restrictions now, and you get this bonfire of the restrictions that we've just had, there is still a lot of caution in there. And I think we need to put a coherent narrative on that. And I don't think that's into the public space
yet. Is it our friend personal responsibility?
Well, actually, interestingly, it avoids using that, and it talks about individual judgment and personal assessment of risk. So the word responsibility, funnily enough. So, and I think that's probably a good thing, actually, thinking of it that way. I think because that kind of sort of moralistic edge to it, that kind of hectoring edge, but it is now going to be, you know, you don't want that.
Is the hectoring over, yeah?
No, it's going to come back.
Or is it?
Okay. No, it absolutely it is. So there is still a need, and I think the coherent narrative about that is really important. As far as I can see, but I'm partly guessing here, I mean, what's really going on here is the restrictions or the guidelines that are remaining in place are largely about protecting vulnerable people where they don't have choice. So where it's public transport and where it's shops and so on, vulnerable people cannot avoid travelling and they cannot avoid going to shops, but they don't have to go into a crowded pub. You know, so we can lift all these restrictions, but there is still a need to protect people, and it is going to be important that the general public understands that and that narrative gets across.
And those people have been very much saying the last few days, we feel we're being forgotten here and everything, so that needs to be part of the story we're telling. Kira, you're nodding there at the personal responsibility bit of things.
I am, but I actually disagree with you, Pete, sorry, a little bit regarding the narrative. I think the cabinet minister, Taoiseach, has been quite clear in saying that it's time to live our lives.
Yeah.
We have to open up for spring and summer. We're hearing that from the Taoiseach for a long time. But they're also saying that, you know, there's many twists and turns to come.
Yeah.
And we can't guarantee that there won't be restrictions again. Public health have told us that there's no rationale for these public health measures. So go and live your life.
But you know, do you not think there's an element, though, Kira, of that? People are so brainwashed by, and it was, Pete, you'd agree, propaganda for the last 2 years, effective and true and necessary propaganda maybe, but people are so brainwashed by it that I was saying this to Katie Hannon yesterday. Some people now almost think that the norm is that society should be shut down and that opening it up is kind of the deviant position, and why would you be opening up? They've now suddenly, some people are saying Tony Holohan has suddenly become this reckless person when for the last 2 years he was John Charles McQuaid, like running an anti-drink dictatorship.
They're being told by the same person now. So, you know, Tony Whelan, Neffet have been very conservative, and cabinet ministers have said, like, they acknowledge that. And maybe some people may struggle to understand how we can lift. But we have been hearing for weeks that Omicron isn't as severe regarding illness and sickness. Yes, it's more transmissible. But we'd seen consistent stabilisation in critical care and in the fall off in hospitalisations, albeit the significant case numbers we had over Christmas. But that was anticipated. We were warned about that. The Taoiseach actually answered that question. So we were warned about this when he was asked and criticised about not having sufficient test and trace system over Christmas, when we saw we had to have significant changes there. But back to the point, I do think people do have to take their own personal responsibility. Society is open. You don't have to go to the pub if you don't want to.
Yeah. I know, but I'm going to come I suppose I would see the people who are vulnerable in our community, the elderly, those with underlying illness. And even prior to this, the ongoing anxiety that they have, that they feel they are being put at risk. The simple things like going into the shop. I can tell you already in the last couple of weeks, from a time when you never saw anybody in a shop because it was totally just unacceptable to be in a shop without a mask, I'm now seeing people in shops without masks. I'm seeing in restaurants, people walking around freely without a mask, including people who are working in them. And it's just that sense of now that we're opening up. I think that the things that are still meant to be, the restrictions that are still meant to be there, which is the wearing the face masks on the public transport and in shops, people will start pushing the boundaries and perhaps not doing that. And I think that's where it becomes unfair. And those people who've really suffered for so long and had to restrict their lives for so long throughout the past 2 years, that they will continue to have that restriction in place. And we owe it to them to be able to protect them. So I think back to what Peter was saying is we need strong, clear messaging coming from the government. It can't be ambiguous in any way. It needs to be definitive. I also think we probably need to hear a bit more from Tony Holohan, because I think people had a huge trust in him.
Yeah.
And now hearing that the things are changing, and that message isn't necessarily coming directly from him anymore. And I think that's a mistake too, because I do think the general public trust him and listen to him.
Yeah, no, he was out at the press conference the other night, Ciara.
But,
yeah.
But may I add, the last two briefings that we've had with Neffet have been put to us that they were technical briefings, but they weren't. They were briefings for journalists, but they were the normal ones we used to go to the Department of Health that were public view.
And they were carried on the RTÉ News channel always.
Yes,
and, yeah.
And the last two briefings that we have had with Neffet have been put to us as technical briefings, and they were no different than the ones that we had in the Department of Health, and we questioned that.
And what was the answer?
Well, the first excuse was given that, we were asked in short...
No, not an excuse, the reason
was put forward to them was that we were asked in short notice to explain, and this is when the restrictions were coming in with Omicron. We were asked in short notice to explain why we had given this advice to government. But like, it would have been so beneficial for the public to sit and watch that as normal. And then secondly, the last technical briefing was about 3 weeks ago, and it was coming towards, Neffet are now going to look at what is the rationale to keep these public health restrictions in place. But we haven't seen Neffet out in the Department of Health like we have for 2 years.
The CMO was there at the press conference after the announcement the other night. There wasn't the same substance in that press conference, I would have said, as previously. You weren't all trying to catch them out about weddings versus hairdressers etc. It was a jolly kind of affair.
If you have this anxiety and you're looking for, people are looking for an explanation as to how has this happened now, well, why haven't we had the likes of Professor Philip Nolan actually sitting then with his slides?
This is interesting. You know? This is interesting. And I think, okay, so clearly,
there was significant shift in the control of Neffet coming out a couple of months back when there was...
So it all dates back to that?
Absolutely. It absolutely does date back to that.
And now we hear that February might be the last meeting of Neffet as we know it, and that will be the final sign off on masks and stuff.
I don't know about that. I think it might be scaled back.
They say the CMO and an advisory body might continue.
Yes.
Now, interesting, just because this is very interesting here. Now we've hit on something, and everyone, Pete started it, Alone is in on it, and you're in it. We have seen in the past, even in recent weeks, remember there was kind of like when the close contact rules were eased up, the CMO then came out on the news and said, look, hang on a minute. We're not saying this is turning into a free for all. There are rules here and we need to keep to them. And he basically gave a more, not negative spin, but a more firmer spin on this is not getting rid of rules. This is changing the rules. These are the new ones. So CMO needs to come out now and explain to people that there are still restrictions. Here's what they are and here's why they are. Yeah.
Yeah, well, remember one of the press conferences, one of the things he spoke at, I think the guidance had come was that Micheál Martin had said, you know, keep to your household or the bubble with no more than six people, different people in it. But yet Tony O'Hoolan came out quite clearly and said, I'd be telling you to keep to your household and no extra people. So there was a huge difference there. I mean, that was a big difference. And I do think he gives sensible advice. He gives advice that's based on medical evidence. And that's why we trust him.
Okay. Okay. Well, we're here for another half an hour if this CMO wants to give us a buzz. Okay. That's interesting. Now, there's other stuff coming out of this. We do one thing before we take a break because I think this is going to become an issue. Pete, you picked out a piece by Dan O'Brien in the Business Post about a better work-life balance is a pandemic change that's here to stay.
Yeah, I'm concerned that we're going to get bounced into having that argument too quickly. Now, of course, we've been talking about the change in work-life balance ever since the pandemic began, so don't get me wrong here. But because this is happening quicker than we expected, I think there's a real danger that actually we get some industrial strife over this. I mean, our data very, very clearly show that people do not want to go back to pre-pandemic life. And because it's now happening much quicker than had been anticipated, I mean, my concern here actually is that they will be pushed towards that and we'll get some industrial strife. I think it's really important that we take our time. I think it's really important that we recognise the vast spectrum within our society about anxiety to do with the disease which interacts with this, which we've already mentioned, but also about people really wanting to change their lifestyle and seeing the pandemic as something that's a real opportunity to do that, and others who just miss the past and want things to go back. And I think there has to be a real degree of tolerance and slow negotiation there that's important. If we get in a situation where people are feeling really pressured, especially when there's still high case numbers, feeling really pressured to go back into workplaces and feel they're not having the opportunity to really have that discussion about where we're going in terms of work-life balance and doing it gradually and getting it right, I think it would be a real mistake.
So we're back to what we were discussing yesterday about that legislation about the right to work remotely, for example, not being ready, that mechanism not being there yet. Then a lot of people, Ciara, I'd say particularly young office workers and young people who haven't met colleagues and all that kind of, I'd say a lot of people dying to get back to the office.
Yeah, I think there's a generational aspect to this as well. I think a lot of young people, and I'll tell you why, but I think a lot of young people who have started new jobs haven't met their colleagues for the first time. You know, the difficulty over Zoom, the meetings, it's very frustrating. Young people as well, they want to be in an office environment that they can head out for a few drinks after working a Thursday or Friday evening to build rapport and to meet new people as well and meet new friends. And then I think you have the generation who are married and have kids, and they may have found themselves commuting for maybe 2 hours a day. Maybe they're handing out extravagant money in childcare that they're able to actually run out for the school run and collect their own child from school. And then for a lot of women, I actually think as well, the opportunity to give them to work from home, it kind of reduces, like I said, the cost of childcare, but makes it easier as well.
Dan O'Brien makes the point that for single parent families and mothers mostly, let's face it, who might not have had the opportunity to go to a conventional job before, this is a way of getting them working and connected into the economy.
Yeah.
People with disabilities, a lot of them, new opportunities for them to work as well. Mm. Ilona, did you notice? So you're kind of like being outside of Dublin and up there. Did you notice that there was new life up there and a new way of life for a lot of people who weren't commuting anymore? Did people move out there or move back home or that kind of thing?
Yeah, definitely. People were, I suppose there are lots of people who were commuting, and it surprised me how many people actually were commuting from Monaghan to Dublin, which is a good 2 hours on the bus and longer in the winter months. So there were people coming back and kind of maybe with the promise that their job in the future, so moving back to Monaghan. So definitely there is that, and the hope is that that will be able to continue. Interestingly, I saw a huge rise in people presenting really stressed last autumn when there was talk about having to start going back before Omicron really kind of upset things again, and when they were being kind of advised that, look, you may prepare, you're going to be coming back into work, and lots of people really stressed about that. It wasn't that necessarily the long commutes, absolutely for those who had the long commutes it was going to be a big deal, but for those who'd gotten used to that idea of working from home, felt safer, felt that they were equally productive. So I think it has to be something we'll discuss. But I'm going to also give you the other side of the argument, which Ciara and myself actually talked about before we came in, which is some of us can't wait to get back to the pre-pandemic type of work. Yeah. And I think there are lots of us, including myself in general practice, where our hours have just lengthened so much more. They've gone to literally 12 to 14 hour days every single working day, extra on call to meet the demands and the out of hours, all of that. And it's not just me as a GP, it's our staff, it's other staff too. And
yeah, you picked out a piece in the Mail today about nurses and burnout and that. Are we going to see that? You know, the way a lot of things seem to be bubbling to the surface now that maybe we've moved into a slightly new phase. Are we going to see a lot of burnout across your area, do you think?
I think so. I think in lots of areas we're going to see that, because I think people have really been working at the 110%, and we know that you can't maintain that and you can't sustain that. And Peter probably would have a great data on this, but we have got to now be ready to pull people back, to protect them again and get them back to that pre-pandemic work level so that they have time to catch up and create the new normal again, get back to what it was like. And if we don't, we're going to lose them. I know in general practice, GPs throughout the country are reporting a high turnover of our admin staff. And that, again, is reflective of the burnout, of the fact that they worked extra hours, they helped us organise vaccine clinics. They dealt with lots of hassle and abuse because people were frustrated or angry, and the only person they can often get through to is the GP surgery. You can't get necessarily through as easily to a hospital setting if your hospital appointment's cancelled. So you may ring us to have a rant. And our staff have definitely felt that.
If there was a mechanism, would the GPs be happy to give their staff that €1,000 tax-free?
Oh, for sure, for sure.
Yeah,
it was so interesting when I listened to Micheál Martin talking about, you know, opening up of everything, and part of it was, you know, continuing on with vaccines and contact your GP surgery to talk about this for the children's vaccines. But the nurses in this article, I suppose we have to accept that they've worked long hours, extra hours, many of them in the full PP with their faces bruised. I mean, there was one really poignant picture on Twitter of a nurse and showing herself coming off with the mask and just the marks on her face, the bruising on her face. You could see the swelling. Working in PP, I mean, we have to do it in general practice for short periods of time, and I actually volunteered to work in COVID hubs first time around. It was exhausting work, and to be doing that every day is really physically challenging and emotionally challenging. So we've got to look after.
Going back to the staff in the GPs, do you think the reality is that I know they're not included in the government one at the moment? Is the reality that GPs who, like people would point out, you've done fairly well out of vaccination. Do you think GPs in general would be happy to give their staff that €1,000? I know there's a €500 voucher you can do once a year for staff tax free, but if there's a mechanism found, you think GPs in general would gladly look after their staff?
Okay, well, I've got to challenge you, and you've done really well out of the vaccines. Vaccines were something we didn't go looking for and didn't necessarily want to do.
I understand all that. But how much did you get per shot?
We got €25 per shot, but I'm going to tell you what work went into that. So we were mandated.
Can I just say you did an amazing job, and up to Christmas there, we all accept that. But it wasn't charity work either.
No, it wasn't charity work, but it was extra work. It was extra hours. It was weekend clinics. It was our staff being paid to work extra clinics and therefore at higher rates of pay. It was all of that. So it definitely wasn't just €25 into my pocket for every jab that was given.
I think it is important, but
that narrative can get out there and can seem that we profited and made a lot of money from COVID, which is not the case. So I think, I really want to be clear
on that. I didn't mean at all to suggest you profited from COVID at all. And I wasn't questioning at all the motivation or bona fides. We'll be clear on that. Look, we're going to talk about something completely different now, but I think this is interesting. Ilona, you picked a piece. There's been a lot of discussion about, we call it gender politics, in the last couple of weeks. You've picked a piece, Ilona, from the Sunday Independent. It's Colin Murphy's piece, and it is about single-sex schooling.
Absolutely. I thought this was very interesting because I suppose there's data on it. So Ireland is unusual with regards to its prominence of single-sex schooling, and with regards to, the article is saying, roughly a third of secondary schools are single-sex. I actually thought it would have been higher in Ireland compared to the UK, where only 6% of students go to single-sex schools. And really what the big thing for me was Dr. Deborah Ging is Associate Professor of Media Studies in Dublin's DCU and researched these issues now only with three schools, albeit in 2017, one all boys, one all girls and one mixed. And I mean, really, it's quite stark. The levels of homophobia, racism, transphobia, sexism, ableism and body shaming were consistently higher in the all boys school compared with the all girls or the co-ed school. And the boys in the same-sex school also reported much higher levels of physical abuse and bullying and much lower levels of belonging, feeling safe. So this isn't an anti-single-sex school by any means. It's not. I don't think it's meant to be that. But I think it opens up the fact that if these are the issues we're seeing in single-sex schools, and obviously from this one piece of data, more so in boys' school, it shows the level of work that we have to do. I remember years ago they always said, well, the single-sex schools were better because there was less distraction. The boys wouldn't be as distracted. The girls wouldn't be as distracted. But there's also information that shows that actually that's not true, that when you kind of put everything together, there's no difference in the academic results from either the single sex or the multi-sex school.
Okay, yeah, because wasn't it always said that the girls did better in single sex schools academically, but not true, no?
Not true. A meta-analysis that drew from 184 studies from 21 countries found that when differences in student background were taken into account, any differences in achievement between single sex and mixed schools was trivial. So I think the real message in this is, I personally, I'm very lucky. My four kids have managed to go to combined sex schools throughout their time, and I think it's just so healthy.
It's much healthier, no doubt about it.
I went to a
great school, but like there was no way that a bunch of lads should be locked up together from the age of 11 or 12 up to 18, and the women be a different species who were down in the school down the road. You know, Pete. I don't know you, but I think I have this kind of sense I've built up of you that you went to some kind of a school in the UK where there was kind of hazing and all kinds of weird practices went on and that there were no girls there at all. Would I be?
Life is always more complex than your assumptions, Brandon.
Okay.
I went to two secondary schools. I initially went to a comprehensive school of 1,700 kids in a mixed area. And then when I was about 14 years old, I moved then to a boys' school for reasons I won't go into. And I have ever since been very, very firmly of the view that co-education is a superior model.
Yeah.
The boys in the boys' school I moved to, I couldn't believe, having been in a mixed school and having an older sister, I couldn't believe the attitudes that I then encountered among boys, even when I was a teenager, towards girls, but also towards each other, how vicious and competitive that all-male environment was. So I have always, throughout my life, because of that personal experience, been a fan of co-educational schooling. I was the chairperson of an Educate Together primary school here when I moved over here. I think co-education is a far superior model, primarily for social reasons, but also actually increasingly the research shows that, I mean, that old excuse about, oh, but it's academically better, just simply does not stand up. Co-education is simply a superior model.
And listen, as a behavioralist, I wonder, is it kind of sexist to say that the presence of girls has a moderating influence on some kind of excess of maleness that goes on, or the worst elements of maleness? But is it something like that, that they moderate each other almost?
I think it's impossible not to conclude that having both males and females at all ages in conversations and in the society that surrounds you is a healthy and good thing, because that is the society that we live in. And when you partial part of it off for extended periods and for purposes and so on, how is that ever going to end well?
Yeah.
Given the society that we live in.
This is how it ends up with men as a tribal kind of thing, and the othering of women by that tribal element of men, and maybe similar. Yeah.
I think so. And I think also, I mean, the boys I grew up with who were in the single-sex school, it was almost like when girls appeared for whatever reason, whether it was at a party or whether you just bumped into them in the street, it's almost like they had to flick a switch and try and work out how to behave differently.
Yeah.
You know, it's like they had two modes of behaviour, one for when the girls were there and one for when they weren't. I mean, that is simply unhealthy. healthy, and it leads to exactly some of the kinds of problems that we are now talking about that occur in adulthood, I believe, certainly.
And Brendan, the other thing, just sorry I'm interrupting here there, but I think the other thing is, I think the combined sex school also makes it easier for the inclusion of others such as same-sex and trans-sex. I think, you know, it just makes a more holistic environment for growing up in and for developing in. And as Peter has said, just it's reflective of normal life.
Exactly. It represents society. When you think about it, it's a bizarre aberration. It's like some kind of primitive tribal thing off the boys.
It's an old mechanism of control. Yeah. And it's an old mechanism of conservative control. That's what it is. And we have the legacy of it. And unfortunately, people still make excuses for it.
Yeah.
I went to a single sex school, both primary and secondary. And I compare myself now to my 14-year-old niece who's in co-ed school. And it's significantly different.
Yeah.
So I can see, like, I remember when we were in school and it's an all-female school and you didn't have male friends. And when you did, you were kind of, you were looked at differently, as in like, how are you friends with him, or are you going out with him? It wasn't normal.
Yeah.
And then I see my niece who has male friends, and she had a birthday party, you know, outdoors a while back, and it was mixed. And that would have never happened at my age. She can just relate better with them as well, you know. So, but interestingly, actually, I changed primary school when we moved house. And there's a school in Bagnallstown where it's co-ed in a primary school up until a certain age. And then the males move on to another school, which I think as well is very, very interesting as well. It's a bizarre situation. But definitely I can see a comparison between the two of us. It's much better co-ed.
So we're all agreed basically that this is a very obvious, and it could make a huge difference, way to start with a lot of the problems we've been discussing in the last few weeks.
I think basically.
Except we're always going to have single sex schools. I think that's just always going to be a way, but it is making the schools understand the special needs that they have with regards to education, and I mean behavioural education that need to be done in those single sex schools. And clearly, boys,
Ilona, teachers can only do so much. Like it is the mob is socialising and educating guys in boys' schools, I think. But anyway, very very interesting little sideline there. Okay, we're going to take a quick break. Pete Lon, Ciara Phelan and Ilona Duffy staying with us.
Text 51551. Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1.